Customers are rushing to your store. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. Shopify POS is your command center for your retail store. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify has everything you need to sell in person. With Shopify, you get a powerhouse selling partner that effortlessly unites your in-person and online sales into the one source of truth. Track every sale across your business in one place and know exactly what's in stock. Connect with customers in line and online. Shopify helps you drive store traffic with plug-and-play tools built for marketing campaigns from TikTok to Instagram and beyond. Get hardware that fits your business, take payments by smartphone, transform your tablet into a point-of-sale system, or use Shopify's POS Go mobile device for a battle-tested solution. Plus, Shopify's award-winning help is there to support your success every step of the way. Do retail right with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/theathletic, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/theathletic to take your retail business to the next level today. shopify.com/theathletic.
The Athletic.
Last-ditch bird catches the worm in Sao Paulo stunner. Roland revels in Nissan revival to plunder Porsche podium. Cassidy calamity as points leader climbs the wall. And Gunter recovers from starting in Rio to grab some points. All that and more coming up in the Race Formula E podcast. Well, hello and welcome after a ridiculously long break between races. We are back, and joining us as ever is the race's intrepid Formula E correspondent Sam Smith, and a very special guest, friend of the show, returning Jaguar TCS team principal James Barkley. James, great to have you back.
Andrew and Sam, great to be back, and nice to be speaking to you post Sao Paulo.
So after a couple of early season races that really didn't fit in with the spirit of what we've seen from Formula E races, certainly with this generation of car, we're back to a bit more energy management, that sort of, to coin a terrible cliche, Peloton style of racing. Was that a welcome return?
Yeah, I think you definitely couldn't call it boring, could you? Losing, you know, racing up to leading the race into the last two corners was definitely not from our side very boring. So yes, I think absolutely kind of brought back that spectacle of strategy, of deciding when to make a move for the lead. It's a fine balance. I think we can go too far and it becomes a bit of a risk. We saw a bit of that with Nick, obviously. But I think, you know, overall, it definitely delivered an incredibly enthralling race that the feedback I've had, at least, is that it was incredibly exciting from lights to flag.
Oh, I think it's impossible to argue with. When you've got a move like that for the win, and further back, as we'll talk a bit later, an equally bold move to fill the podium places, that's what people want to see, and the build up to all of that, I mean, that's just part of the narrative, isn't it? And it doesn't really matter if they're, maybe some of the moves are artificial, they're not, because it's all about being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, there isn't a move that's not happening for a reason, right? And as you say, it's all part of a strategy, a game plan that the team and the drivers are working towards. So yes, it's about making sure you're in the right place at the right time, sometimes conceding position on purpose, sometimes taking position on purpose. So it is very much a real race. And I think the key thing that we always strike the right balance is that it's a combination of all the right things, right? The team, the driver, the car delivering the results. And as long as we're not losing one of those key elements in the way the format is, then I think overall we're winning as a championship, right? And I think we have seen some of the Peloton races where they go too extreme. We always want a race where still the team, the manufacturer that delivers the best car and track also stands a chance of really showcasing that. So it's a fine balance. But I think Sao Paulo 2 years in a row now has delivered an incredibly exciting race where it has, I would say, overall delivered on those three elements.
Now, I suspect we're going to be seeing reruns of Sandberg's pass for the win, repeated over and over again. But what's it like being on the receiving end of that? I guess you just have to salute the brilliance of it, do you?
Yeah, there's nothing. When you're in a position and you have a race like that, just hats off to Sam, hats off to McLaren. You know, they absolutely delivered a fantastic race. And you have to admit sometimes that someone's just pipped you in, and that's exactly what happened. I think in Formula E, you can never think you're safe, right? And even on that last lap, even I knew where we were. We were critical on a number of items, as so many other cars in the field were. And we thought we'd just about managed it. We knew there's some risk on that last lap. But ultimately, yeah, I think they played it really, really well. I think also Sam leading the race for as long as he did is quite contrary to some of the Peloton style. But actually, the race was not just about the state of charge. It was actually about the thermal management as well. So you were managing those two factors. And on the latter, I think they managed that really, really well. And yeah, hats off to them. If we hadn't had that slight derate on our side, just and that, those last two corners, it would have been the bag. But we were ultimately kind of pipped by Sam and McLaren, who got it that slight bit better than us.
So I think I'm right in saying that's the second hottest Formula E race we've ever had. Was it sort of beyond expectation, and that's why this thermal challenge became so prominent?
Yeah, as you say, it's right up there, without a doubt, right up there. Obviously, the duty cycle of that racetrack is different to others where we've seen really high temperatures in the past. You have the long, long straights, which obviously add a bit more strain as well. So, yeah, it was absolutely right on edge. And we knew it before the race. In fact, a couple of teams even came to me and said, what do you guys think? So it was clear to me before the start of the race that we were all thinking the same things. It's not very often that you have even other teams come and ask your thoughts as well. So the fact that I was hearing that across the field, we all knew what it was going to be like. And yeah, I think if you look across the field, you know, between McLaren and ourselves, we ultimately managed it the best. And I think it was a really, really tough race. You saw cars with excess energy just not being able to do anything with that energy as well. So yeah, it was, you know, sometimes it's easy. You can look at one element, which is your state of charge. Say easy is understating it. But when you're having to balance track position, when to overtake, when to defend, your state of charge, your energy save, and the thermal, it is a huge amount to do. So kudos to those who can come out on top.
So Sam, you were out there, no doubt, in a bit of a hot, sweaty mess. How much of a role did that heat play in the outcome of that race?
Oh, I mean, it was the critical element of the race, that's for sure. You know, just to explain that these Gen 3 batteries are much more Bijou than their predecessors in Gen 2. They're smaller batteries, but they also have a temperature model. So that has to be managed properly. Very high ambient temperatures, as we saw last week, throughout the whole week of Sao Paulo. But a part of what they have to do is to help cool the car. We heard Sam Bird getting that from his engineer, Stephen Lane, that he needed to cool the right-hand side of his car, so effectively get out the slipstream. So when you're following cars closely, it's great for the overall efficiency of the, you know, managing your energy. But of course, the downside of that is that you tend to get spikier temperatures. So you've got to manage that. There's a bit of a spiral, actually, of how the teams have to deal with various elements of running these Gen 3 cars. And that's just one. You know, the other one is that some of the key aspects of the Gen 3 car incorporates the front powertrain as well, and the brakes and the tyres, and it all contributes to pace, and is something that these multitasking geniuses of the drivers and engineers really have to grasp when they're doing a race. It's like I said, it's a real spiral because the lap consumption is what is taken from the battery minus what is being regenerated in energy. If you regenerate more energy per lap, you need to take more from the battery. That stands to reason. But the more you do that, the bigger effect it has on brake temperatures as well, which, because drivers are having to use the mechanical brakes rather than the electrical brakes, the brake by wire more, it pushes up the brake temperatures and then also the tyre pressures. So it affects everything in the car. And I think from what Mitch was saying on the slowdown, like when he was venting his obvious frustration in losing that probable victory, you know, it actually cuts. You get a legality cut, and the derating nature of what he was managing, as were others, just leaves you completely at the whim of whoever's behind you. So as great as Sam's move was on that last corner, and it was a great move, it was aided by the fact that Mitch just wasn't able to defend properly. And I think this mix of both that and the FIA getting the sort of coefficient, if you like, correct this time, which it didn't do in Mexico and in Diriyah with the usable energy, which was 38.5 kilowatt hours for this race as opposed to 40 last year at Sao Paulo, just made it a real potboiler of a race. And yeah, it was just spot on. It was that great balance. James mentioned balance before, and they got the balance of this right, and with the temperatures being the primary factor, it just made for one of Formula E's best ever races.
So you've been at, I think, all bar two of the races, or maybe three. Where do you rank that move of Sam's for the win?
Well, like I said, I thought it was obviously affected by the fact that Mitch wasn't able to defend as he should have been able to defend. So I think you've got to pull it back a little bit there. It was still a really, really good move in the context of it being the penultimate corner. I personally wouldn't put it up there with the Costas move, and Sam has made some mega moves in Gen 1 and Gen 2 as well. I think Da Costa's is hard to topple. Cape Town, in the dying stages of that race. I think it's going to be something special to top that. But it was, you know, it's definitely in the top 10, particularly in the context of it being the penultimate corner of the race.
So James, you mentioned earlier the problem that Nick had in the pack racing. At what point was it clear to the team that there was an issue with that wing? And in hindsight, do you think it would have been better off sort of calling him in?
So, yeah, we just talked about kind of the kind of race we saw, and Mitch was in that kind of that great spot, right? And you have to be in a certain group rotating and at the top sort of six cars. And as soon as you essentially sometimes start to drop back, another race in the past, we see it's fine being further back. But what you saw actually was the cars who were a bit further back, they really were starting to drive quite quickly and defend quite heavily, and you get that concertina effect. So as we said, unfortunately, yeah, Nick got a couple of bites on that front wing, and that started to wear loose. Now, actually, it looks stable from our perspective, and it's something we were absolutely monitoring at that point in the race very closely. In fact, I said to Sam straight after the race, I'd actually had some comments with the engineering team just to say, let's keep an eye on it, right? Because clearly we want to make sure that it is stable, but it really was. So having looked stable, all of a sudden the wing started to come loose and very quickly, Nick was unfortunately in the wall. So one of those occasions where we do monitor it, you're always kind of managing that combination of making sure it's safe, but also making sure you're still in a position to try and compete if it is. And sadly that didn't quite work out for us. Shame, because Nick had great pace, and we were just looking for the right time to start progressing him forward. But as I said, actually not that easy that far where we were in the pack with him. And you saw that with a number of cars. So yeah, unfortunately, the negative side of the Peloton effect is, particularly Sao Paulo, where you have the chicanes, this big concertina effect, which it makes it really tricky for the drivers following to judge their braking points or just how much corner speed to carry. Main thing is Nick was okay, and we can rebuild and turn things around, obviously, for Tokyo.
He was actually one of several drivers to have damaged noses in that race. And, you know, I remember Mexico last season, the first ever Gen 3 race, and Jake Dennis, if you remember, in qualifying, had a damaged nose, and he wasn't able to challenge Degrassi for pole on that occasion. That was the first ever race. And I wrote something saying, you know, the FIA need to take the initiative here, because that could, you know, a nose going underneath the wheels could contribute to a huge accident. And then we saw one at Portland last season, didn't we? We saw Nico Müller go off the track, and there was four or five laps where the opportunity existed for him to be called in. Now, you know, you can argue the toss on it forever. You know, a team isn't going to call a driver in and lose any aspect of a race unless it's completely obvious. But there must be a way with what people can do, you know, these incredible devices that the FIA and Magneti Marelli and various others have. I know that's electronical stuff, but there must be a way of evidencing that these wings, you know, are about to fail, or you know,
that could be a load sensor, right? Then there must be,
exactly.
James, you'll know what the critical load sensing is on the front wing before it breaks.
Yeah,
don't you?
That's a good call. And I just think it's it gets to the point where it's extremely dangerous. You know, if Nick had been going into Sandevot, where there's a hard stop at Monaco, you know, he could have hurt himself there. And I just think there has to be an external way of trying to make these calls, because it is a safety issue, and everybody said it, you know, safety is the priority. And I don't think that should be forgotten in this, because although it was a deflected impact for Nick, it still was a big one. It's just thankful that it wasn't a hard stop into a barrier there, because like I say, that it could have had a different outcome.
And as you say, Sam, it's a difficult one to judge, isn't it? Because, you know, the levels of damage we see, sometimes a wing is absolutely fine, and we've seen a wing with some small damage that has no issue at all. So it's a careful balance, isn't it? What we don't want is, particularly with the racing we see when it's so close, is for half the field to be coming in to have wings changed, right, and really kind of ruining the spectacle. But at the same time, anything we can do to make those wings either a bit stronger, or in fact, as you say, maybe add some technology in to give us a view on whether the load is at a point where the wing is going to fail. It's the first one we've ever seen in a championship that's gone under our front wheels. So we've been racing for 8 years. So, it's a rare occasion. As a team, we obviously always prioritise safety. That is really important for us. And I think I said to you after racing, I said, I'd actually just been up, had the conversation, let's keep an eye on it. And then sure enough, before I even got back to my desk, the wing had failed. So, yeah, as always with these things, there's things you can take away and learn. And I think the importance is we do that together with the FIA, but at the same time, not an extreme where anytime there's a tiny bit of damage, you're bringing a car in, because we see close racing in Formula E, and that's the balance.
I think the Gen 3 Evo car is going to be a bit different anyway, so hopefully it'll improve the durability of the front wing next season.
It's a law of unintended consequences, isn't it? Because you could beef up the front wing, but then what does it do? Does it end up damaging the rear of cars when they knock into them, and you end up causing punctures or rear suspension damages or whatever? Do you think it was as much a, like you say, that circuit does tend to produce really good racing, and the design of those corners might mean that naturally it is a bit of a front wing killer, and that this is a bit more of a one-off than the trend?
Yeah, I think, and Sam, jump in here as well. From my perspective, I think this is the balance of everything. I talk about the balance a lot, and the reason for that is, one is the peloton style race. You know, if you make extreme concertina effects, the likelihood, no matter what category, you have incidents like we saw. So we don't want to go too far in that type of racing as well. And I think if we do get it right, then you actually you minimize the damage as well, right? We didn't see as much wing damage at the races early this season. Some would argue that we had too much energy, and therefore the racing was too flat out, and we lost some of the strategy elements. So again, there's not one reason, there's always a number of contributing factors. And I think that is a little bit of the byproduct of the kind of race that we had in Sao Paulo, because of the energy, because of the circuit of its nature. We saw the same in Berlin last year, didn't we? So I think, it's an important consideration when we look at the amount of available energy we have for the race as well, because particularly with some circuits, it definitely brings it to the forefront. The double hairpins in Berlin has always been a nightmare. You add a low energy target and it almost gets worse. So again, it's all these contributing factors we have to consider when deciding what action to take and how best to ensure we don't have too much damage.
Yeah, I agree. The other thing the FIA will be looking at is Nick's right rear coming off pretty easily. It was a big whack, but it did impact the front, and then it must have snagged the wall at an angle, and it got ripped off and just bounced over De Grasse's car, I think. And you know, nobody wants to see a whole wheel and on the track, because you know, you hit that and it can bounce anywhere. So the FIA will be looking at that, and you know, there are tethers obviously on the front of the front wheels, but there aren't on the rear, which is fixed. Is that right? I think that's right. Yeah, they don't have tethers on the back, obviously, because they've got the drive shafts and the suspension on. But yeah, I think there'll be some concern from the FIA that was able to come off so easily at you know, a relatively slow speed once he'd scrubbed it off against the wall.
On a positive note, that was Sam Bird's first win in over three seasons, I think. James, obviously, you worked very closely with him. How pleased were you for him, even if it is a rival team that he drives for now?
Yeah, no, to be honest, I actually said to Ian when he signed Sam that the the likelihood is Sam would be winning races with them. So yeah, we had a fantastic time together with Sam. You know, clearly the fact that he was incredibly close in Sao Paulo as well last year. So I think from our perspective, he's an incredibly accomplished racing driver in Formula E. We know when Sam has the bit between his teeth and the opportunity, he's absolutely going to be there in the fight. So I think from our perspective, no surprise really. They're a great team. They know exactly what they're doing. They have some fantastic personnel, and with Sam fired up and in the right position, we know he's always going to be dangerous. And sure enough, he delivered on what he's done many times before in Formula E.
I think we were all slightly surprised at how things petered out for him in those last couple of seasons with you guys. Do you ever really put your finger on what happened?
Yeah, I mean, of course, if you look back, actually, you think even back to the seasons where he was in a position to win the championship, even if we go back to 2022, right, Sam was actually in a very strong position for the championship with us. Bear in mind, he won his only second ever race with us. So yeah. Sam had some fantastic results with the team, and he really helped us achieve our second place finish in the championship last year. And you know, following on from bringing actually the more to the team when he joined us, we learned a lot from Sam as well. So he contributed a huge amount to where we are today. Yes, I think you can look back and say probably we didn't together fulfill the potential. But if you also look, there were some fantastic moments, some fantastic results. And I think when the decision came to go our different ways, it was because ultimately, I think, you know, Sam could achieve more in a different environment and vice versa. So I think from our point of view, we only look back really fondly. And I'm really thankful and proud of what Sam did achieve with us as a team. But ultimately, yeah, I think the step he's made and we've made is ultimately been the best for both of us as well.
Well, Mitch didn't quite get the win. That second place has extended your lead in the team's championship even further. You must be pretty pleased with the way the season is playing out so far.
Yeah, absolutely. And firstly, just touching on Mitch, I think his performance has been really, really strong this year. His race in Mexico, managing massive steering loads, you know, we were a bit of the wrong way on the setup there. And he was holding off Jev was phenomenal in Mexico. So that was a really, really strong race. Super cool head throughout a very stressful race for him. The performance in Diria, the pace was absolutely there. So really nice to see him get the results. Real shame we couldn't quite get the win because I think he drove again a fantastic race in Sao Paulo. So Mitch absolutely kind of now in third in the Drivers' Championship, absolutely in good position there. And the season, as you say, for the team has also started incredibly well. So our best ever start to be leading, having that 35-point lead now is positive. My biggest point I always say with the team, though, is we can never be complacent, right? It's one of the most dangerous things as a racing team to ever be complacent. So it's a fantastic start. I'd rather we have this buffer than be chasing from behind at this point. It's nice to be in a position that we haven't been in before, having a good start. So from our perspective, I do really feel that it's testament to the huge amount of work that the men and women in this team have put together to not only build a really competitive car in the I-Type 6, but actually to really execute fantastic race strategies and put ourselves in this position. And it's been no secret. We've had technical changes, obviously, over the winter. And for team members in slightly revised positions and having more responsibility in certain areas, they really are stepping up to the plate. So I couldn't be prouder of the team, you know, many of which have been with us right from the start of this journey together, which is incredibly cool. So, yeah, I'm very proud, very happy, but obviously it's a long way to go. And as I said, complacency is incredibly dangerous. So our focus is heads down, eyes forward on approaching each race with the best possible preparation and getting ourselves in that position to continue to score points everywhere we go. And that's going to be the focus right to the end of the year because the competition is incredibly strong. We all know that. And Sam, I think you put a post out how privileged we are to be part of this World Championship. It does absolutely deliver thrilling racing. And from a team point of view, I can guarantee you the stress levels are incredibly high when you have races like that. And our job is to kind of keep cool, keep calm and keep preparing as best we can to turn up with a chance of competing for points, as I said.
A little bit of context on Mitch's race. It's often forgotten now that he didn't do a lap in free practice too. Had a front drive shaft problem. And he did zero. I mean, I think he got out, didn't he, at the end for an installation lap, but that was it. To pull out the qualifying performance that he did and then have the race that he did and should have won it, you know, if he hadn't have had these sapping thermal issues. That's a very, very, very strong weekend for Mitch Evans, considering that he lost the vast majority of that crucial free practice running. So, you know, he and his team dragged it back, and I think, you know, that's highly impressive that he was able to do that.
Yeah, and Sam, on that point, I actually spoke to Mitch after the race and as part of our debrief, and I just sat down with him at the end and said, I've got to be honest, that is a phenomenal performance. The fact is, you've done one lap of free practice, come through the duels. That quali duel, that lap in the group stages to get through, you know, with really no reference, can't go underestimated just how much commitment he put on the line for that group stage to get through the duels. And then, you know, we knew up against Stoffel in the duels without really much track time, it was going to be difficult because, you know, we know that both those DS Penske cars have been fast in practice. So I 100% agree with you there. And for me, it was a particular discussion Mitch and I had after the race and to his whole team about how calm they kept throughout the whole process of FP2 through to quali.
Sam, how important was this result for Mitch to sort of change the direction of travel with how things were playing out with that inter-team battle with Nick Cassidy there?
Yeah, I mean, there's been quite a lot made of that in some areas of the media. Not with us, because from what I've seen between Nick and Mitch and speaking to members of the team, including James, you know, they are genuinely friends and constructive colleagues within the team. I've had zero hint of any kind of corrosive rivalry, which you often get in other teams, or any hint of it. So I don't see that, and I think they're all working towards the greater good of the team. Obviously, they're looking after number one on the track, and they were close together in Riyadh, and there was a bit of orchestration, and there was a, you know, on Mitch's side, there was some frustration from him on communications, but it was nothing to do directly with Nick. You know, they've known each other for 80% of their lives, and they've got great stories to tell. Two Kiwis from the same town racing in an international, in a world championship. It's a lovely story, and I just see nothing but harmony there. You know, obviously, with human nature being what it is, there is scope for some friction, and I'm sure there will be, but I don't see it affecting either of them as much as it would with other drivers in other teams and within other manufacturing team combination. So I don't see that happening. Obviously, there's a part of every media and journalist that wants to see it happen because it's great to write about, but no, there's no hint of it at the minute, and nor should there be, because they've both got great results, they're both close together in the championship. So yeah, nothing to report, nothing to see just yet.
How's it working behind the scene, James? Because it's unusual to have a situation where the drivers are such close friends as those two are. Often they develop a friendship, but it's rare that they have a bond such as that.
Yeah, I think you said it really well there, Andrew. And Sam mentioned it, because they've grown up together, racing from literally go-karts all the way through their junior single-seater careers. And they, you know, I remember even before Nick was in the championship, Mitch was talking a lot about Nick to us. And so that strength of relationship is there. And what we see inside the team is two drivers who are very close to each other, have a lot of history together, and there's a huge amount of trust between the two of them. So as Sam said, there's been some times over this year where they're, you know, I can, of all the things we're thinking about and focusing on, that is absolutely not one of them, because that relationship is incredibly strong. So yeah, from our point of view, it's actually working really well. That harmony Sam talked about is absolutely prevalent in the team, which is a really nice place to be. And having two drivers as capable as they both are, who are working together, is really positive. They both bring different strengths to the team, which I think is also really really positive. But yeah, from our point of view, it's a relationship that I think, because of their time together and their history together, is far deeper than most in the paddock, if any in the paddock, I would say. And as Sam said, you know, that doesn't mean there aren't times they're going to be racing close and the tensions are there, but it's not there's not a personal tension between the two of them. It's actually, you know, they both are trying to do the best themselves, and we all agree that the priority is obviously, we're all here to race for Jaguar and to try and get the best possible results for the team, and obviously in supporting their drivers' championships as well. So yeah, I think from our perspective, a relationship which is really strong. It's great to see how happy they are when one achieves and is successful. They genuinely are really happy for each other when someone gets a result. And you heard that on the radio with Nick in Diria with Mitch, when he felt that was Mitch's podium, and Mitch went for that move, it didn't quite pay off. That was genuine. There was nothing orchestrated about that. And likewise, when Mitch had seen that Nick had gone off in Sao Paulo, he was the first on the radio checking everything was okay. So yeah, that friendship is real, and I think we only benefit from that as a team.
There's a great case study, isn't there? Because obviously what happened in Rome last year when Mitch made a mistake and effectively took both of them out of serious championship running, in a sense. I spoke to Nick, must have been the next race in London, and they both went for a coffee the morning after in Monaco, because they live really close to each other, obviously, in Monaco. And they went for a coffee thinking it'd be a half-hour discussion to pick the bones out of what happened. And they ended up chatting for 3 hours. And, they both went away from it knowing how each other felt, and they dealt with it, and it was forgotten. That's the way to do it, isn't it? You don't let things fester. If there is an issue and there is an incident, you talk about it as adults, and you go away from it, shake your hands, and have another coffee the next week. So, there's, like I said, there's nothing really to see. It's even when they do collide on track and they have an issue, which is, if that had been two other drivers, it would have or could have festered and brought more problems henceforth. So that's how they deal with things. And it's a typical Antipodean way of doing it, isn't it? A typical Kiwi thing of doing it. Say what you think and get over it and discuss it like adults. And then they went and watched a load of rugby matches in the World Cup together. So yeah, they're obviously genuinely good chums.
People starting to talk with a bit of a Kiwi twang in the garage now. James, is it picking? Is it catching on?
Yeah, we've got definitely a strong Kiwi kind of influence now, and there's a few South Africans. So there's definitely a Southern Hemisphere element within the team. But listen, I love, people say having two Kiwi drivers. I love the fact that the two of them have come from so far away, right? They left, literally their homes, their families, at an incredibly young age, and they've got this real kind of determination. Both of them, they have this trait. This incredible determination and the strength of character, because I think they've had to make such a big move at such a young age. So yeah, even if we pick up a bit of the accent, I also just love the spirit, right? They've committed a lot. They've really been focused on leaving their lives behind in New Zealand to come and forward their career. Whether it was Nick in Japan, Mitch moving to the UK at a young age, they have that kind of similar trait, which is incredibly cool. And I really, as men, as racing drivers, they're great, great, great characters.
Which one's Bruce and which one's Denny, James?
Yeah, we'll not decide on that yet. It's a good point, Sam. We have to work it out. But Chris Amon was someone who I grew up really admiring, right? And I think he had that similar grit, similar determination. But as you say, also the ability to be, be able to put things behind and move forward and be calm in those key moments. And when the pressure's on as well, I think that's one of the things which both of them absolutely deliver. And just going back to Mitch's performance, on the weekend, and we saw that throughout Mitch's season last year and indeed Nick's season. When the pressure's on, they are both incredibly cool. And when they have to deliver, they do deliver. And that's the impressive thing for both of them for me.
So next, off to Japan, I guess as close as either of them get to a home race, because obviously Nick had a very successful career over there, and as I imagine, quite a passionate fan club following. It's obviously a race that I think Formula E, it's one of those totemic races that we want. Tokyo is a city that should be on a Formula E calendar, and if you're doing your dream calendar, Tokyo is on it. So how much are you looking forward to that one, James?
Honestly, it's a race that they're all exciting, but I must say this one really stands out in terms of how everyone feels heading into Tokyo. To have the first ever race in Tokyo is incredible. It reminds us our first ever race as a team was in Hong Kong, and so it has that feeling, that spirit of pioneering, bringing this incredible championship to the city streets of Tokyo, a country which loves their racing, that's passionate about their racing. Yeah, it's one honestly we can't wait for. And we have it seems to be incredibly popular already. We have a huge amount of sponsors and partners and media and guests that are coming to the race. So, I think I think that that's testament to in itself and to the, how much it's looking for, everyone's looking forward to it. So we can judge by the reality of what people are signing up to come and join us and be with us, which is incredibly cool. And I know from Nick's perspective, he's absolutely, you know, looking forward to racing in front of, you know, the passionate fans that followed him throughout his successful time in Japan. So no, incredibly cool. And everyone is looking forward, I think it's fair to say.
Cassidy's going to be a tour guide for the whole paddock, isn't he? Cassidy, Lotterer, who else is there? Probably just those two who've raced. Oh, Fenestraz as well. They're going to be sort of inundated with requests for the best sushi bar or the best sake in town.
You might have set up a taxi company, Cass Cabs.
Oh, yeah, I'm like that. Sure.
Yeah. Cass Cabs, slightly, yeah, it's good.
Shuffling people around to various karaoke bars in the increasingly deteriorating states of sobriety. Before you go, have to ask you about your cameo appearance on The Apprentice. Did you watch the show?
So I didn't watch it straight away. I had to watch it in the end because obviously it was a fair amount of time in filming, but it's fair to say Jake and I had a bit of a joke to say that the 2 days of film we had, we didn't seem to necessarily, maybe we didn't cut the mustard in terms of our acting skills. So, but yeah, our short cameo was I think nonetheless got a fair bit of attention for the championship.
Oh, so there's more of you on the cutting room floor then?
Oh, there's quite a lot, to be honest, Andrew. So yeah, we weren't sure whether we maybe, like I said, Hollywood's clearly not calling for both of us.
I think I'm not going to go over old ground other than say it was a bit of a missed opportunity, but there we go. I'm going to be on the ground in Tokyo, really looking forward to that and catching up in person. Thank you so much for joining us on the show today, James.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, Sam. Good to be with you guys.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard. As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All, less work, more clean. Terms apply.
Great to have James on. Some fabulous insights there into all the emotions and stuff that was going on. But it wasn't just the fight for the win that had a great move. There was I think we only saw it a little bit later in the highlights. There was a great pass for third where yeah. Ollie Rowland mugged the two Porsches, one Porsche, one Andretti, in a single move. Take us through it, Sam.
Oh, it was great stuff. I mean, as Tom, the commentator, Tom Brooks, was going through a vocal range that would have made Bjork blush in the background, I was, because Bird had obviously done it, in the background, I was watching the scrap for third, and the cameras kind of missed the element of it naturally because they were focusing on Bird's
movement.
I think
they could be excused for that one.
Yeah, we'll give them that one. But Oliver Rowland was in fifth place going into the final corner, and he came out of it in third place to get the last rung of the podium. It was epic, a fantastic move from Oliver, who he sort of alluded to it afterwards to me that it was, you know, it was very much carved out of his karting manual from his years of karting. So Dennis was in third and Verline was fourth as they went into the last few corners. Both were struggling with various issues related to temperature and settings on the car. And they had a bit of a wheel banging session, lost momentum. And Roland saw this ahead and he sort of pulled over to the left and then acutely cut into the apex and just got a better drive out of the last corner and took it by, I think, 0.089 seconds.
Brilliant.
So 800ths of a second. It was super close. They almost went across the line as one. It was wonderful stuff. If you haven't seen it, go to the...
It's a switchback of all switchbacks.
It was very much a great switchback move. If you haven't seen it, go to the Formula E YouTube page because it's really worth looking at on board with Ollie. And you can tell as he crosses the line, the sort of the squeals that he and the team are making. It was, you know, it was a great moment. So fantastic for Roland. You know, his race was really carved earlier on. He qualified 11th and he came through. To give you an idea of where he was on the first lap, he was in a fight with Nico Müller and almost got driven into the wall by the Apt Cupra driver. So that gives you a sense of where he came from to finish third. Excellent podium and the second consecutive podium and some real great momentum for Oliver on his return to Nissan.
So with Nissan Power in the McLaren and that, are they back now? Have they joined the fight with Jag and Porsche as the lead sort of powertrain in this series now?
Yeah, well, in my mind, they've always been the sleeping giant, if you will. And we saw flashes of it last year, particularly on one lap pace at Cape Town and Monaco when Fenestraz got pole positions. And Nato did a great job in Rome, remember. So it's always been a car capable of a big result. It's just never quite got it together. And it's showing signs now that it can do. And obviously, it's delivered with Sam Bird's McLaren, Nissan-powered McLaren. So I think with some of the circuits coming up, and I said this consistently this season, particularly Misano and Shanghai, where you've got very smooth surfaces and you've got races where there is an element of significant efficiency needed, I really fancy Nissan for both of those races. I think they could be favourites and could actually, on merit, completely join the Jaguars and Porsches and be a real threat, which, you know, all of a sudden makes an 8-car possibility of winning become 12 cars, doesn't it? So you could end up with a dozen cars genuinely in the mix. You know, whereas McLaren and Nissan are showing that form, DS Penske are kind of just in a bit of a stasis at the moment. They're just stuck. They're just they just don't seem to have made any particular impression on what they had last year. They're not slow. They're quick, and they're quick on one lap pace, as we saw with Van Dorn lining up on the front row again in Sao Paulo. But when it came to the race, they just had nothing to give. They were just stuck. They lost track position, and then they were unable to make any progress. So, it could well be that, as it stands, Nissan, with their four cars, are the ones who are genuinely able to get to the level of Jaguar and Porsche over race distance. And that's great for the championship because, you know, it makes a dozen cars capable of winning on merit.
Not a stellar race for Porsche, and those two sort of tripping each other up probably didn't add too many smiles to their faces. But this is more of a sort of blip, isn't it, due to the circumstances of that race?
Yeah, but how often are we saying that now? You know, we were saying that sort of consistently since last season, and you know they've had some terrific performances. Mexico, Verline got another pole position in Sao Paulo. The pace was there. You know, at one stage in that race, he was almost 2% up on energy to everybody else. But once the safety cars came in and the fact that they tripped up themselves, you know, they Da Costa and Verline really didn't help each other in sort of orchestration when they were close together in that early stage and both led the race briefly. They just weren't able to latch on to, you know, Verline was behind Evans for lap after lap unable to make a move. And that's ultimately where they just lost any chance of featuring for the victory of that race. You know, they weren't able to go with Bird and Evans. And Da Costa, I think part of Antonio's mindset was that he just needed a strong result in the top sort of six or seven. And that's what he achieved. So that's good for him and what he can do going forwards. But for Wehrlein, you know, I did speak to him after the race, and it was a frosty Wehrlein. You know, it was a tight-lipped Wehrlein. There was a lot of frustration there, both in the fact that I think Porsche's strategy sort of tripped themselves up, and then the wheel banging with Jake Dennis. I don't think those two. There was a bit of a rapprochement before the start of the season. That's lasted. That's lasted four races.
I'm they amazed really, got that far in fairness.
They really, really do not like each other on the track. You know, I think off it, you know, it's not so bad really, but they do not get on when they are fighting for a piece of racetrack. And they both scupper themselves really, and that's where Roland, you know, did that amazing opportunistic move. So yeah, not Porsche's finest race, but still they took some strong points. So it's okay for the team's point of view. But certainly there was a lot of frustration from Pascal Wehrlein after that, after the Sao Paulo Ypres.
So we were speaking about Da Costa before and his very open struggles to get his head around it. An improved performance, is that enough? Does he feel like he knows where he's going now? Is he back, or is it too early to make any definitive judgments?
Yeah, I think it's a good bedrock for him. As I said, he just needed a clean race and a strong qualifying, which he got, and then a good stable race where he got a bunch of points. So I think that would have been something he'd have taken away from the weekend before it had started. But yeah, you know, with him being Antonio Felix Da Costa, an ex-champion and multiple Ypres winner, a lot more will be expected now. You know, this should be a springboard to seeing the old Da Costa, the Cape Town Da Costa and the London Da Costa last year, of really fighting for victories and, you know, leading the team as he should be. So not all the work is done there. There's still a lot to do, but yeah, you know, a solid performance from Antonio, and I think he'll now be a bit more confident that, you know, he can get back on proper par with his teammate.
I mentioned in the intro jokingly about Max Gunter starting from Rio, but he had a 40 place grid penalty. I don't understand is how you can have a 40 place grid penalty and start last, right? Because that just makes a mockery of it. Once you've had effectively a 10 place penalty, you're already last, but the other 30 are irrelevant. So yeah. One, how the hell do you rack up so many penalties? And well, two, he did a brilliant job to come through from that to grab some points.
Yeah,
so
he did.
Deconstruct that drive, because there was so much going on. It was very hard to chart his trajectory.
Yeah, and sadly we didn't see any of it because there was so much going on at the front of the field. So Maserati decided to change their gearbox before, you know, they knew this after Riyadh, that they saw obviously something in the data that could be an issue, and they chose to change that. There are no technical jokers this year in the second season of the iteration of Gen 3. That's usually the case in regulations. So they had to take a penalty for that, which was a 20 place grid penalty. So he already knew he was going to start at the back of the grid. Did an excellent job in qualifying. Should have, you know, without the penalty, would have lined up third. Did a terrific series of laps throughout the qualifying phase, and then it was communicated that he had an extra 20 place grid penalty for a inverter change, which was a separate incident, or a separate issue rather, to the gearbox problem. So it meant that he was not only at the back, but the places that he couldn't take up because there was no further place to go back, he had to take a 10 second penalty in the race, which is part and parcel of the regulation. So he knew that he had to have the rub of the green with a safety car. He got that when Nick Cassidy crashed his car. So he was able to latch onto the back of the the first one was for debris, wasn't it? Sorry. The first safety car was for debris.
Front wing bits all over the track for most of the race, but they put a safety car out for that one.
They did, sorry. That was the first one. That allowed him to tow up to the back of the field, remained on the lead lap. And from there, he made phenomenal progress. You know, a series of overtakes. I asked him about some of them, and he said some of them were, excuse me, some of them were extremely satisfying. So hopefully we see that in an edit after the, you know, after the dust has settled from Sao Paulo. And then in the last few laps, he made an audacious down the inside move. I'm trying to think who it was on. It may have been on Van Dorn, and it didn't come off. And it looked, for all the world, it was one of those where in the background you just see these smoking tires, and you think, well, that's the end of, you know, that progress. that's the end of Max's progress. But he somehow made the corner and hung on to ninth place. So a very energetic race. You know, full credit to Max Gunter, because it was one of the drives of the race, if not the drive of the race, really. And you know, just continues his amazing form, really, since Jakarta last season. You know, he's one of the top performers in Formula E, and all in a team that has had to recalibrate after so many changes and difficulties off the track, really. So yeah, that'll give him a real extra shot of confidence, and I expect him to, on occasion this season, to be the one exciting sort of, you know, cameo merchant outside the top teams that we mentioned in terms of the what they've got from a powertrain. So, yeah, it's it should be good cabaret.
Yeah, it was a complete contrast to the other Stellantis team, the DS, which you sort of mentioned. Very competitive over one lap, but I mean, dropping like a stone really during the race. So it's all a bit bizarre, isn't it?
Yeah, they just didn't have the they just didn't have the pace, really. I sort of inquired after it, and there was nothing much to say other than Stoffel and Jean-Eric got shuffled down pretty early and just got stuck and were never able to have the pace to you know. I'm sure that they were suffering as well with temperatures, but that wasn't offered as a primary excuse. And they just had a very sort of middling race behind the top five or six, and you know, they ended up with seventh and eighth position. So yeah, not a great day at the office, but you know, if you don't have a great day at the office and you get a, you know, you do get some points, it's not all bad. But that team is ultra competitive. It was the talk of the town, obviously, and something that we reported very early on at the end of last year was that Phil Charles was joining that team, and he walked through those turnstiles with you know, white, black and gold uniform on, which was a genuine double take moment. You know, you're often used to seeing him in the black and white of Jaguar, and there he was in different colours. But I had a good long chat with Phil on the Thursday before the race, and he gave his rationale for moving from Jaguar to DS.
How quickly can he make his presence felt?
Well, he did go into this. I think there are certain things that he'll be able to help with, technically and operationally, with the team. You know, he's sort of famed for those skills. But I think expecting him to make changes where Vern and Van Dorn can go out and start winning races and exploit the car or what they have and find little avenues of pace is pushing it a bit, really. I don't expect this season to be much more than, you know, the occasional threat, podiums, possible poles, and you know, maybe a fortunate win. I mean, fortunate in the sense of being in the right place at the right time and doing the great job that they usually do with strategy and so forth. But I don't think there'll be a championship threat for Porsche and Jaguar, particularly those drivers. But he's really there in a sense to manage their test and development for Gen 3 Evo, which starts next year, and then looking further ahead for Gen 4, obviously. So it's much more of a long-term project for him personally.
Of the other established front runners, it was a very underwhelming race for Envision, which you had to really look at the timing sheets to work out where they were. I mean, Buemi bobbing around the bottom of the top 10, Robin Freins, you know, on a different page. So why was that?
Yes, it's hard to give an accurate answer, because I did speak to both Buemi and Freins after the race. They just didn't have they just didn't have the pace. You know, they, again, the qualifying was poor for both of them. They were down at the rear end of the grid. They were never able to get on terms or make progress. And I think the big difference this year is that the knowledge that the teams have of this car and how the races are run, particularly the energy big energy management races, I don't think it's as easy as it once was to carve through the grid and do these real Top Gear from the rear sort of numbers that we've seen previously.
Well, I mean, but we just talked about Gunter doing that, so it was possible.
Well, that's a very good point. I just think that if you haven't got the if you haven't got the full package, particularly mechanical grip, which is, I think, something that they sort of didn't have last weekend to their usual extent, you know, they kind of then sort of second guess themselves, and then they start over saving. So you can over save energy, and you can just be too conservative. I mean, we saw it a little bit, didn't we, with Bird pushing to the front. I mean, there was one phase in that, you know, we saw it with Cassidy last year, didn't we, of just like going and getting track position, go and get track position, then sort it out after that. And just make sure that you're in the mix at the front. And I'm surprised others didn't do that. Obviously, Gunter was on a completely separate thing with his penalty and so forth, so it's almost a different, distinct challenge. But both Fryants, lesser extent Buemi, who actually did make progress, who went from 18th to 10th and drove a good race. But, you know, that rare thing at the end of the race, Sebastian Buemi confused. He was just confused about why, you know, at this race they weren't able to make progress, or progress that they should have done with a Jaguar powertrain. But I think it is a genuine combination of others having made strides and sort of understanding and enhancing their software more, and their overall package to sort of being hard to overtake when it comes to energy, you know, true energy restrictive races. So yeah, but that, you know, there was nothing wrong as far as I know with Fryants' car. He finished last, you know, he was suffering with battery temperatures towards the end, but so were others. No other excuse. It was just a really, you know, just one to forget. They just need to completely forget about that, try and learn from some aspects of it. But yeah, it just never happened for them.
Yeah, two other drivers with races to forget, the local heroes, Sergio Sete Câmara and Lucas Degrassi. Aside from knocking wings off, difficult to recall much from their endeavours.
Yeah, I mean, Degrassi, he had more hits than Taylor Swift last weekend. There's one for the Gen whatevers.
Down with the kids.
Oh, yeah. he got turfed off by Nato at turn one, for which Nato got a penalty rightly. He had a bit of a stinker actually to Norman last weekend. He wasn't anywhere to be seen. Lots of issues on his side of the garage, and, you know, mistakes from him in the race. Who else did he get hit by? I'm trying to think now. He had an incident with a Mahindra, maybe both Mahindras, went across the runoff. Then he hit somebody else. I mean, it was just a mess. Another forgettable home race. How often do we see drivers going to home races and having appalling races? I mean, you know, Mark Webber was famous for it, wasn't he, and with his Australian Grand Prix, Jenson Button, the British Grand Prix. And then in Formula E, we now have two Brazilians, the other being Sergio Sete Câmara, who just have really, really dreadful races. I mean, Sete Câmara's was just awful. You know, it looked like, or it sounded like, the communication between he and his team was just a bit of a mess. He was complaining that he wasn't being relayed accurate information. He went over the usable energy, so got disqualified in the end anyway. You know, at one stage it looked like, I think he was 13th, at one stage you're looking like he might have a sniff of the points, and then it just all went to pot, and he ended up not getting a classified finish. So yeah, miserable time for the hometown heroes, unfortunately.
So that's it for the on-track action, but off-track as ever in Formula E, there's plenty going on, including that vote that you had mentioned in the last show about whether the WEC and Formula E calendars could find a way of harmonising so that there'd be a full complement of the usual drivers on the grid for the second race in Berlin, and we got stalemate.
Yeah, this is quite complex. I'll just give you the headlines. Four drivers.
Yeah, please do, because we're quite a way in here. We want people to make it to the end.
yeah, we don't want anyone to lose the will to live on e-votes and stuff. But anyway, I'll give it very, very basics. Four drivers, Robin Fryant, Sebastian Buemi, Nico Müller, and Nyck de Vries, were compromised by the clash with the WEC race at Spa for mid-May. But there was a possibility that they could do the Sunday race. They do the Spa race, the WEC race on the Saturday, fly over to Berlin and do the Sunday race. That is now not possible because both races count as one event. So regulatory wise, you cannot change drivers other than force majeure. So to stop any shenanigans, such as drivers mysteriously tripping over in the shower or having a dodgy prawn the night before, because nobody wants to see all that sort of jiggery-pokery going on. Yeah. So what they did was they put it to a vote whether they could genuinely change the drivers and amend the regulations for that race and that race only. And unsurprisingly, 5 of the 11 teams said no. You know, you made your decisions on your drivers. You knew about the clashes. So tough luck, buddy. And, you know, you can see that point of view. I spoke to Roger Griffiths of Andretti on this, and he passed up the opportunities to sign drivers. Ironically, one of them probably Robin Freins, an old boy at Andretti. And they went with Norman Nato because Nato was very clear that even if he did WEC, which he is doing with Jota, he would absolutely prioritise by contract that he would do Formula E. So some teams thought about that and did it. Envision went another way and took a risk, and now they everybody's frustrated about the clash, and it shouldn't happen, but forgetting about that, you know, you plan accordingly, and Envision haven't. They took a risk, and they're going to have to swallow it, unfortunately. Doesn't taste nice, but that's what they're going to have to do. So those 4 drivers will be replaced for both of the Berlin races, and we won't see them at all at Tempelhof.
Oh well, I mean, it is what it is. So I understand you almost flattened a pensioner in the Emotion Club.
Yes, I was in the Emotion Club talking to a couple of people, not idly scoffing cheese and biscuits like you do. I was
porn sandwiches,
stalking a few people. Stalking a few people. I came down the stairs, turned the corner, not concentrated, looking at my phone, bumped into this little squat fella, and I looked up from my phone. I nearly knocked him over, and it was Bernard Charles Eccleston. So, if you're going to bump into and almost wipe out a nonagenarian, then Bernie Eccleston's quite a good hit, isn't it? I did apologise, and he sort of grunted at me, and then I sort of took in the magnitude of what had happened, and immediately messaged you and said, if you're going to get fired for something, then killing Bernie Eccleston's probably quite a good way to go.
So he was one of a few sort of famous-y faces there. Emerson Fittipaldi. I was so desperate to do a little bit of a piss take then, but I'll go with Emerson. And Felipe Massa around. Other Brazilian racing royalty? Ingo Hoffmann not knocking around?
How niche can we get on this podcast? No Ingo Hoffmann. No, I didn't. I don't know. I don't think the last year there was Pippo Durrani though, but he was busy inverting his Cadillac and Sebring. Good to see Pippo walk out of that. He's a good friend of mine, so it's a big one that. No, Massa drove the Gen 3 car, but only briefly, did a couple of laps, and then it conked out and he got towed back to the paddock. He did a little round table with some of us in the media, and obviously my first question was about his court case, and he sort of clammed up a little bit.
How could there be any other question?
Well, exactly. So, you know, he didn't say much, but I think everybody's just completely baffled by the whole thing there. But we do digress. Emerson Fittipaldi. What a great... It's always great. You know, you just stop what you're doing and you look at Emerson Fittipaldi, you go, that guy's been there, seen it and done it, is a legend, amazing. A walking, breathing legend. And he actually flew the checkered flag. You know, sporting legends go, he did a lot better than Pelé did years ago.
Let's not go there.
Yeah, and he joined McLaren on the podium. So you had this lovely, you know, 50 years on, this year, you had this lovely shot after the race of them celebrating the win with the guy who brought McLaren its first F1 World Championship. So lovely, yeah, a lovely sort of sign-off to the weekend.
Anything else that you want to discuss from the paddock? What's going on with our app's powertrain deal?
Yeah, I mean, we won't go into the NRE cost for Gen 4 because people are just... You know,
I just saw it on a script and instantly skipped past it.
Yeah, we'll leave that for another time when people do need some rest and sleep. Apt Porsche. So the Apt Porsche deal, which was much mooted and it was discussed for months and months between the two parties, it is not going to happen. That has fallen over. That was confirmed to me by Florian Modlinger in the paddock on Saturday.
So what are they going to do then? What are the options?
Well, it leaves Apt with a real struggle now to find a powertrain for next season. Obviously, they have terminated their Mahindra deal after this season. It leaves.
Are there any new powertrain manufacturers coming in?
Well, it's funny you should mention that, V2B. We're going to have a story coming up quite soon that there could potentially be one.
So we're not quite ready.
Not yet. Absolutely confirmed yet, but that is right. One possibility for apps. The other is potentially something out of the remnants of the Stellantis situation, which is still uncertain what DS and Maserati are going to do in the future. So there could be some bones to pick out of that. But let's see. It's a fast moving story, that one, and I expect maybe by the end of this week, and when this podcast is even published, that we'll have a bit more news on what's going on.
And the final one says here that the Sao Paulo race might move to December to kick off the new season. I'm all in favour of this, and much in favour of Formula E going back to being a bit of a winter series. So races in December, bring them back.
Could be our own little Temporada series there. Another reference for the kids out there. The hot rumour is that the championship will start in early December, and then it could be Sao Paulo. So we could have two races in Sao Paulo in the calendar year. Let's see. It's not defined yet. I think a lot of it depends on if they're able to get a second US race for around that time of year as well, for the logistics of that, and then Mexico City. So yeah, it'd be great. And I think everybody loves going to Sao Paulo. It's a terrific venue. I found a lovely hotel in the centre as well, so I'd be happy to book that again at the end of this year.
I feel like it's one I need to get to next year. So if that's a December one, I might get myself out to
look. Yeah, I'll have a word with Bernie if he's available.
I'll promise not to knock him over.
Yeah, at least he wasn't tooled up this time.
And on that note, we've got a very special show coming up next, which we will be doing on site for the Tokyo E-Pre. We won't say much more than that, because I've got some ideas that I haven't shared with you yet, Sam, so it might come as a bit of a surprise to you too. But no, really looking forward to that. As ever, make sure you check out all the latest breaking Formula E news on the-race.com, and don't forget to search out the rest of our fabulous podcast output. I think Bring Back V10s is coming to the end of its current series, but I know we have got for fans of motorsport history, a fantastic, exciting new series coming probably by the end of this month, maybe the beginning of next month. We're just working on the first few episodes for that. Super exciting. And then obviously with the Formula One, IndyCar and MotoGP championships in full flow, we've got podcast for you there. So thank you very much and goodbye.
The Athletic.